Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Josh Davis and Althea Spencer Miller.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone.
Wonderful to be with you again. Very excited today because this is our podcast discussion for the last Sunday after Epiphany, which means we are at the close of the first full part after the Christmas season of a cycle in the lectionary year. So our readings today reflect the proximity of this Sunday to Ash Wednesday. In other words, whenever you hear this podcast for the Wednesday after the Sunday readings to which it relates, that will be the Wednesday of Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent, and that will be a long period of time before Easter. Easter, as you know, is a movable feast, and this year in 2020, Easter comes up on April the 12th. So between the last Sunday after Epiphany, we have several Sundays of Lent. We have about six Sundays of Lent, the sixth being Palm Sunday. So most of the readings of today's lectionary choices reflect strengthening before Ash Wednesday. Look at the way that the collect describes it. O God, who before the passion of your only begotten Son revealed his glory upon the holy mountain, grant to us that we, beholding by faith the light of his countenance, may be strengthened to bear our cross and be changed into his likeness from glory to glory through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. So the purpose, at least as far as one reading of that collect might go, the prayer for this last Sunday after Epiphany, is to strengthen us as we look into the season of Lent, the lengthening of days that is Lent, the time of penitence that is traditional in the season of Lent as it prepares for Easter. So in ancient Christian tradition, Lent was the time of catechism, of teaching, of the shriving of souls in preparation to be baptized in at the end of Lent, in Easter. So all these readings and the collect seem to focus on strengthening of humans, human existence by God's grace, God's revelation, God's glory. And the Exodus 24 passage reflects that. Moses is instructed to come up the mountain by God, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and commandment. And Moses goes up the mountain, and the cloud covers the mountain, and the glory of the Lord settles on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covers it for 6 days. And the appearance of the glory of the Lord is like a devouring fire on top of the mountain. And this word glory might be one of the key elements of today's readings. And I would like to, not now, but soon with you both, spend some time discussing the changes in meaning of that word glory as it first appears in Hebrew, then the Greek translation of the Hebrew, and then as it appears in, for example, the Gospel. If I jump to the Gospel, Matthew 17, 1-9, there we see the transfiguration of Jesus alone with Peter, James, and John. And that is in some ways the manifestation of glory. So the other readings, Psalm 2, this is the revolt, the uprising of the kings of the earth, and the identification of God of a king. Verse 6, I myself have set up my king, says God, upon my holy hill of Zion. You are my son. Verse 7, this day have I begotten you. And then the rest of the psalm goes on to talk about the strength of the chosen king, the chosen ruler of God. Psalm 99, which is the alternative one, is a description of the trembling of the people in the presence of the enthroned God, verse 1, upon the cherubim and the shaking of the earth. the greatness of God, and so on and so on. The epistle from 2 Peter 1:16 to 21 is another way of reading the description of the glory of God. So the power of, the author of 2 Peter writes, the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. We had been eyewitness of that majesty, for he received honor and glory from God the Father when that voice was conveyed to him by the majestic glory, saying, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." A reference to transfiguration, perhaps a reference to baptism. So that's a brief run through of the lectionary readings focusing on a theme of glory. What should we start with, my friends?
If I could, I can jump in, I think.
Great.
But before I do, I wondered, Deirdre, if you could say some more about the change from, is it Shekinah to
yes
in the Hebrew and the Greek?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You didn't miss it at all. I'm looking at Exodus 24:15, which comes up in the readings, and verse 16 identifies in the New Revised Standard Version translation, the glory of the Lord settles on Mount Sinai and the cloud covers it for 6 days. And verse 17 says, now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire. And that word glory goes back to the Hebrew word kavod. The Hebrew word kavod, which Hebrew scholars know much more about than I do, conveys the notion of a weighty physical presence, a substantial cloud, a devouring fire. And this word kavod has been rendered into the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures by the Greek word doxa, doxa. And in classical Greek, in Plato or Aristotle, doxa is the word for opinion, thought process. But what has happened is that the translators of the Hebrew Bible into Greek have transformed the meaning of doxa so that now it conveys glory. This is how it comes to be behind the rendering of the English word glory, and itself is transformed from its opinion in classical Greek into the Septuagintal Greek, the Greek of the translation of the Hebrew Bible, into the word doxa. Now, that word doxa then appears in the Greek text of the New Testament as glory, not opinion, but as glory. So the Septuagint, the Greek text, has influenced the way New Testament writers use that term glory. And doxa reminds us of the influence of the Hebrew Bible into the Greek text of the New Testament. So that, for example, when the Lord's Prayer concludes in Matthew 6 and Luke 11, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the doxa, the glory. Mm-hmm. So this word then appears consistently in the New Testament. So that's what I was thinking of, Althea.
How on earth do we get from opinion to glory? Because in Plato, it's doxa is the opposite of truth, right? Or knowledge, gnosis. And so, and it's the thing that you're supposed to avoid because it's just, the sophists traffic in and sell doxa, right? Just opinions and this
yes,
kind of
but
thing.
It isn't just for sale. It isn't just for sale. It's noetic. It's noetic. It's the noetic processes that doxa describes. And you know the Greeks have many, many words for describing noetic processes because that's what interests the process of education. That's how you do paideia. That's how education is envisaged. So I'm not quite sure. Maybe it has to do with other factors besides people sitting around in 2nd century BCE Alexandria. Maybe it has to do with the fact that there's a need to render the Hebrew Bible into Greek. Let's start there. Mm-hmm. And other people besides the translators of the Hebrew Bible are doing it, like Philo of Alexandria in the first century of the Common Era. Josephus is doing it in the first century. And I think that they are also, remember, the text of the Septuagint is not fixed. It's not like Philo is opening the Hebrew Bible in Greek.
Right.
So what he might be doing is reflecting in Alexandria, because he uses the term glory to describe the glory of God when he's interpreting Exodus and the traditions about God's glory. So it may be that there's a kind of confluence of work at that time in an attempt to discuss how to render this in a Greek setting, and somehow the meaning of that glory has been already transformed from Plato into Alexandria to mean something like philosophical opinion, but it also carries the weight of opinion as well. And maybe it's that weight connotation. I don't know. It would be worth a longer discussion and investigation. It's a great question, Josh.
So it has something to do with I would guess it, doxa in this sense is a form of knowing, but it's like tradition or something like a culture, like the kind of thing that a culture would have, would the way they would think or their practices.
Well,
or something
it's
like that.
Perhaps a simple way I could and should have explained it before was it's always connected to the Lord, to God. So it's doxa tou Theou, the glory of God. And so and in verse 17, the form of the glory of the Lord, the shape of the glory of the Lord. In other words, it's always derivative.
Right.
So that derivation of it may have to do with the fact that it's reflecting something theological, the glory of God.
Not to make this, can I follow one real question? The form there, what is the word for form?
Well, it's in verse 17, it's eidos. Yes, the form.
That's
yes. I'm so glad you asked that question as well. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because eidos is the opposite of doxa in Plato.
Yes.
So if you're saying here the eidos of the doxa of the Lord, that's just fascinating.
Exactly. 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 Althea.
I think it's very fascinating and worth, as Deirdre was saying, and as you both are doing, worth further study. The only thing I might add into this comes out of little moments in your conversation. I'm, as usual, tapping into the notion of cultures. And I'm also thinking about the semiotic worth and value of the language doxa, eidos, in different settings. While you were talking, I got out a lexicon.
Oh, good. What a good idea.
And I found, I'm going to select which form of doxa I'm looking at. But indeed, to think, suppose, hold an opinion attributed to Aeschylus and Plato, among others.
Yep.
But magnify, extol, and praise attributed to Thucydides and Plutarch. And then when you get into the New Testament, you have to clothe with splendor and to glorify. So each context is adding or has already had a value that the word holds. And whether they're all subsumed into each other in any one moment or dispersed in other moments, or influential on each other, it's not clear. But I think it's such a helpful discussion, one, just for the information that you're giving, but also to remind us that as we read this English has a tendency to go to favor exact meaning.
Yep.
When we're dealing with languages, translation from languages, which hold multiplicity in terms of the connotations of the word, so that in a sense denotation is subjugated to connotation, whereas English would uplift denotation and subjugate connotation. But how does all of that translate? I think I'm going to end up where we are at, to recognize that this notion of the glory of the Lord is perhaps inadequately expressed in some liturgical settings when we go for puffs of smoke and magnificent light and all that kind of dramatic display. I'm not saying it shouldn't happen, but to say that it might miss some of the kabod. It might miss some of the substance and weightiness and impact because it goes more towards a spectacular. Whereas we're here seeing in these passages that glory has impact, glory has function, glory has weight, even if it's about magnifying and extolling. And that doesn't quite get to what Josh was asking about how do you get from opinion to glory. It's not an exact explanation, but I'm playing with what you were saying, that have different settings where the words have different meanings and different weights, and each setting might perhaps have some bleeding into the other as we think about the meaning of these words.
Right. I mean, I suppose it has something to do with the idea of like what a group of people praise or value or something like that, which is what Plato is always trying to get beyond, right?
Right.
Let's say we need fundamental sort of mathematical, formal knowledge of truth and those kinds of things.
Right.
And that's why I particularly keyed in on the idea that we might have a form, right, of the doxa of God. That's particularly interesting, but it was super helpful to talk about praising and worshiping and recognizing and valuing. That's, yeah.
So you give me a chance to look up, as Althea did, a different dictionary. This is Speak, S-P-I-C-Q, a wonderful French scholar, who makes the point that doxa can also be opinion held by others concerning something. So doxa comes to be renown or reputation. In the case, for example, of Philip of Macedon in Demosthenes, that Philip is Alexander's father. Philip is the father of Alexander the Great. Doxa is renown or reputation. So Philip is in love with fame. He has a passion for it. So esteem or honor then passes into Koine Greek, and honor is the connotation of doxa that's picked up in Exodus 24 and in Matthew 17. So that's just a brief, we could create a link to that. That would be a good thing to do in our website where we post our podcasts, right? That would be good. And Althea, if you could send me the link to yours too, that would be helpful.
I will try to find it, as actually being very old school.
Yeah. Yeah, Speak is pretty old too. Yep.
Well, you know what would be great, if you took a photo of it and then forwarded it to one of us, and then we could post it in our notes.
Excellent. I can do.
I'm good. Yes.
Yep.
Could we return to the original meaning of kavod, to just unpack that a little bit? I sort of zeroed in on the doxa thing, but I'd like to just explore that a little bit more about what the mindset is here in the Hebrew Bible about the glory of the Lord.
Right. So in Isaiah, the whole universe is full of God's doxa. That is to say, the splendor of God's majesty. So this could be unpacked to mean God's mighty deeds, God's interventions in overturning adversaries, and God's salvific function. Mm-hmm. So when the text, like Exodus 16:10, says the glory of Yahweh appeared, mm-hmm. that can become a manifestation of God's deity, and as an image of Yahweh, as a visible image. It could be a raging fire, as our passage describes, on top of the mountain, or the cloud that hovers over it for several days. Is that the kind of thing you're asking?
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how it might be how it might have originally suggested something different from the kind of thing that's being lifted out in the Septuagint and the traditions of exile. Because it is interesting, right, that Philo picks up on this word doxa to translate this. So it's a different worldview in some ways. And I was just wanting to explore what that, you know, a weighty cloud. I hate to put it this way, but it's a little more earthy vision or material vision of glory or something along those lines, rather than intellectual or like you said, noetic.
Yes. In the Hebrew text, it's always linked in, at least in our passage, the glory of the Lord. And there's a little line between the word glory and the word Lord. Do you see? Mm-hmm. So it's a descriptor. It's connected. A dash.
Mm-hmm.
We need a Hebrew Bible specialist.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. We should flag that for a future discussion, Althea.
Yes. And do some homework on it. I'm looking at the Matthew passage. And First Peter, and wondering what have we possibly lost by the unhinging of doxa from the weightiness of kabod. And is it asking myself, is it recoverable?
So can you say more about that?
Yes, I'm kind of peering at the text as I'm looking at them. Here, just really trying to will them to give me something of power here.
That's wonderful.
That's how we all work as exegetes, right?
but here's where I'm going to go for a moment. It's not explicit in the text, but I'm thinking about the world behind the text, the historical context and the times. And I'm thinking with 2 Peter and with, especially with 2 Peter, because there is a question about the dating of 2 Peter, whether it was written before Peter was executed and therefore by him, mm-hmm. or written after his execution by a disciple. And those who are thinking that it's just before he dies, sees 2 Peter, the letter, as a kind of last will and testament.
Right.
By Peter.
Right.
But where I'm going to go a little generic is that whether it's before or after, given the way scholars have thought about it, it is a critical time. And a time of change, a time perhaps of uncertainty, a time when people are needing some kind of reassurance. And the language of glory in such a time has got to be the kind of language that communicates to people a reason to continue, a reason to go on. And I'm wondering if, you know, as I do this peering into and then behind the text, I am wondering if those persons who first heard these words read for them were not doing the kind of separation that I'm doing. And this is one of those questions you can't really answer with definiteness. But how would they have heard it? Would they have heard it just with majesty and glory and exaltation? Or would they have heard majesty and glory and exaltation with a kind of earthy functioning that you've been pointing to, Josh, so that a God who has majesty and glory but no power is not good enough for such a time as this?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly where I was wanting to see about how we might recuperate those original Hebrew connotations in this, especially in the Matthew passage as well. There's something, the glory shown on this mountain. It's not just something that I don't know. I don't want to be negative about the idea of contemplation or meditation, but it's not just a contemplative insight,
right?
Something, but it's right. But that contemplation is itself is physically transformative, because that's what's being described here. A transformation of the material world, right? His clothes,
yes,
became dazzling white, and his face shone like the sun. This kind of thing.
Yep.
And so, in much the same way that you see in the Hebrew Bible, the earth, you know, declares the glory of God.
Yep.
And I think about there's just something very mythological about the language here.
Yep.
A transporting into another cosmos, another kind of universe, mm-hmm. where the language is ample enough. It has a kind of size, a magnitude to catch us up into itself and enable us to see something that we probably wouldn't normally be looking at, and something important for this time. And I'm saying it because 2 Peter 1 verse 16, we did not follow cleverly devised myths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there is a kind of mythologizing of the universe, a mythologizing of time that may not be, it's great, it's clever, but it's not our kind of way of describing the world and our God that we're worshiping actually in majesty, in glory, has power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this word, cleverly devised myths, is sophizo, which connects to the word sophist, of course, mm-hmm. and it which is what we've been discussing. Yeah, so we're not following those sophistic ways. Yeah. We're receiving prophecy as eyewitnesses. Because the conceit of 2 Peter is that this is Peter who was at the Transfiguration.
Mm-hmm.
When I say conceit, I just mean this is what the author intends the readers to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so in verse 18, 2 Peter 1:18, we ourselves heard this voice come from heaven while we were with him. And that gives us prophetic message, not sophistry, but prophetic message.
Message, yeah.
With other holy men and women who spoke, you know, God's word. So there's an anti-sophistry message here.
Right. As I recall, Irenaeus contrasts the biblical, the rule of the Bible, the rule of faith, I guess you could call it, although that might be a bit early, with myth.
Yes.
And I don't think it was necessarily intended as a disparagement, but to point in a certain kind of direction about how it is, like that, something along the lines of, like, this is not merely allegorical or moralizing or something along those lines, but we're actually talking about a person. And in this case, Jesus, right? We're not just talking about Odysseus, who can be morally significant to us. If you think about, Odysseus is a funny example of Greek morality because he's a good liar. So they sort of celebrate that as a form of virtue, right? Because he's cunning. But you can see in that a kind of a universal, general principle of human virtue.
Yep.
There's a way, I think, to see this idea of contrasting with myth. We're not just talking about merely allegories, but we're talking about a human being, a specific person. And I think that's an interesting way to read this.
Yes. I mean, Irenaeus of Lyon wrote against heresies as he saw them. And those he describes seem to be full of abstract celestial entities. Yeah, and that's the contrast he wishes to make. Yes. I don't want to be sidetracked into abstract celestial entities.
We could start talking about Valentinus and
that's
all of that.
That's it. And I mean, I myself believe that Valentinus was a particular kind of Christian in Rome, in mid-second century Rome. So I don't mean to say that it isn't complicated. It is complicated.
Right.
Yeah.
It is complicated. And there is one aspect of it that is internal Christian mythological contestations. And then in 2 Peter, I am hearing, I think we're hearing, the not only internal Christian myths, but Greek myths also, the sophistry, the sophists.
Yep.
And even rhetorical schools. But when Josh says we're talking about a human being, part of my meanderings here, I just see, think about the need to distance yourself from those, distance Christians from those other mythologies. And one of the ways that you do it, it's by connecting your narrative to something that you believe to be historically real. The Lord Jesus Christ is historically real.
Yep.
The Christian mythology is not primordial time chronologically. The Christian mythology just happened a few years ago. That is real. That is history. It's not just our imaginations. We're actually constructing on real things that happened amongst us, and we are witnesses too. The value of glory, I think, can be grounded in that kind of way, that it connects to reality and then it enlarges reality and gives us a way to live through the tribulation, to the times of trial.
Yep.
Because we are part of a powerful glory.
Mm-hmm.
It is extraordinary to me that the lectionary has created the juxtaposition between the Transfiguration and Lent, which could be a juxtaposition that goes back pretty early, but from Matthew's Gospel, there's no reason to see the Transfiguration as a preface to a time of fasting and preparation. Do you see? So I understand what you're saying, Althea, and I can see how people have understood the Transfiguration to function that way. And I can see it particularly when if we look at the Lucan version of the Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah with Jesus are discussing his exodus from Jesus' exodus, Jesus' departure, Jesus' death and crucifixion. So it's a way of strengthening Jesus for the trial of the passion and death that is to come. But Lent, which is the creation of the lectionary, let me just put it that way. Lent, as I've written, Lent is for us. It's for us. It's not for Jesus. So we need to kind of keep those things separate. We need to keep those things separate. Jesus doesn't need Lent in order to get to Easter.
No, he doesn't.
Right.
And certainly not in the narrative. But like, could it be that like us, the Matthean community needed a narrative? They didn't have a Lent like we do either. They're post all of this.
Yes. Yes, of course. I mean, Jesus is going to be betrayed, and that's one of the things that happens once Jesus comes down the mountain. You know, down the mountain is as much a real thing as it is metaphorical. It's sort of descent from the celestial to the mundane. And in that mundane world, there's betrayal and suffering and death and so on. Yes, exactly. But in 1724, there's the payment of the temple tax. Do you know, life goes on, you have to, death and taxes, you know, universal phenomena. So I just want to make sure that people think separately of how the lectionary is using Matthew Transfiguration from, as you point out, Althea, from Jesus in Matthew, from the Matthean community, and other early Jesus followers.
Yeah, it's a lot to hold.
Yeah.
And I think I might confine some of my statement, my comments about the role of power and glory to what Peter's community was going, what could have been going through in their historical context. But we'd have to imagine something different for the Matthean community and certainly for ourselves and for Jesus.
Yep.
In the narrative.
Yep. But I think we can hold those things together. I mean, we can hold Peter's use of the transfiguration event, you know, the transmission of the information about the transmission event and Matthew's transmission of that event, as opposed to our use of those passages in the creation of them to sustain followers of Jesus who embark now on Lent before they get to Easter. We can hold those things together.
Yeah, I think we can. I think we ought to.
Yeah.
And to observe, as we're doing so, to make even more explicit, I think, something you just said, Deirdre, that the Second Peter passage is actually pulling on the transfiguration experience even more specifically than one might want to associate, say, with the baptism, more specifically on the transfiguration. And so the Second Peter passage would have been written maybe a little later than Matthew. What do you think?
Yeah, perhaps a little later. Yeah, perhaps.
A little later than Matthew.
But
the whatever work Matthew 17 does in the overall narrative plot of Matthew, either Second Peter is pulling from this source, Matthew, or one of the gospel sources, or it's pulling from some other kind of narrative that was in the air that they knew of. But then this transfiguration work, this notion that the Jesus whom we serve is God's beloved son, is deployed to function for a time of hardship, such as we are ritually entering into as we look to.
And just to pick up something that Josh was saying too, we can also see that what Matthew's transfiguration passage is doing is picking up the experience of Moses in Exodus. So what happens to Moses in Exodus 24 is the gathering up of Moses himself into the presence of God and the effect of that upon Moses. And the means by which that's manifest is not just in transformed expression, transformed physiognomy, but it's also in the gift of the law that Moses brings as the presence of God down out of the mountain. Right? So we can hold on to that experience of the presence of God.
Yeah. And we have both Moses, the law, and Elijah, the prophets.
Exactly.
And there's this interesting thing that's happening with his, you know, the glory in Moses' face, which he veils. He has to veil his face because that glory shines out. And then you see this, his face, Jesus on the mountain shines with this glory. There's a dynamic at work of veiling and unveiling, I think. Something that we see. I don't think that we should see this in a supersessionist way, because what you're seeing in Jesus is the glory of Moses that shone in Moses's face, right? It's a taking away of the veil, and I think what is interesting in this contrast about myth, etc., is that there's a way in which the cross of Christ specifically is what reveals this glory. Right. And this would drive us back, I suppose. This is the line of thought that I'm interested in, is the way that this drives this glory back toward the things of this earth. Right. That a crucified man, a tortured man, becomes the means by which the veil is lifted so that we see this glory shining in the material world.
Yes. And the dazzling brightness becomes part of the transformation of Easter, the crucifixion, and the experience of resurrection, because this bright, dazzling color is angelic clothing.
Mm-hmm. And the speaking of the Matthean passage, Matthew 17, and thinking with Lent, thinking about times of difficulty, crisis, trial, and responses that we might have in the present, we can identify with the response of the disciples in the presence of such a magnificent, transcendent kind of transfiguring experience. They fell to the ground and were overcome by fear.
Yep.
And Jesus touches them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid," which is quite a trick he's asking them to do, because then they get up and there's nothing else but Jesus himself alone.
Yes.
You know, what happened to Moses and Elijah after I fell down? Maybe I should be afraid.
Yep.
But we might live in such a narrative world in this moment where the unexpected happens, the inexplicable happens. And the word is, don't be afraid.
Yep, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. I remember once listening to a sermon on the Transfiguration several years ago, and it was manifested in the preacher's sunglasses as she ascended the pulpit.
Oh,
it was
oh
very
God.
Funny. And when she turned around, she had a backpack on because she was going up the mountain to the Transfiguration, so which was sort of the opposite. I mean, there was no surprise there. You know, I'm off for a sojourn into the high mountain with God. But it was actually very effective in some ways too. So, yeah, there are lots of different possibilities. Okay, we've been dwelling on transcendental things, which is a wonderful thing to do. And Josh has reminded us of terrestrial things as well. So that's very helpful. What else might we say that could be useful?
I suppose I would just want to underscore not just the way that there's a kind of terrestrial emphasis here on glory, but that I think it's important to the writers of scripture that it's not just about the person of Jesus. I mean, I think that's hugely important, but that it's what happens to this person. It's the fact that he is the one who goes to the cross, and that there's something in the cross specifically that's a key for seeing how these different scriptures hang together. That's what I see in these passages of from Exodus to the epistle to the gospel, that there's although they don't talk specifically about the cross, but that's always hovering in the background when we're talking about the New Testament authors and writers. There's like, what is this? We were eyewitnesses to his majesty. But you know, as you see in like in John, if you read that with John in mind, you know, he's lifting up. He's
right.
being lifted up, right.
right?
And his being lifted up is the
yes.
cross.
Yes.
And his being lifted up is to pull everything,
yes.
and, you know, all things to him.
Exactly.
And those are the kinds of resonances that I'm seeing and hearing here. And there's glory in this devastating, traumatic event. And somehow this devastating, traumatic loss an apparent winning of
yes.
the imperial powers is the thing that displays the glory. And that's, I think that's particularly powerful and worth coming back to.
Absolutely.
I think pertinent, because we are pivoting. These are our last readings for this, what has been a very powerful time of epiphany.
Right.
And now it's pivoting us. It's beginning the turn to Lent.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of Lent, we have the Passion and the Resurrection.
Mm.
And we're being moved through to that kind of time. And you said some words there, Josh, which I think are touchstone words. I can't repeat them verbatim, but the idea that around the cross, the victory of the empire is established. The victory of Rome is established.
Mm.
The collusion of some Jewish authorities, the consequence of some Jewish anxieties in that time, the ways in which peoples are being tossed this way and that trying to figure out, where is a Messiah in this time? What are we to be loyal to? All of that gathers in a very terrestrial, in a very earthy, in a very political kind of way around the cross. Mm-hmm. And then it's, oh, rise up. Don't be afraid, because after the cross, there's this other story that begins, a story which might be foreseen in Psalm 99. The Lord is king. Let the people tremble. He's enthroned upon the cherubim. Let the earth quake. The Lord is great in Zion. He spoke out of the pillar of clouds. But that which we have faith in is not something measly. It's not something minor. Mm. But even if the cross is our way, is that which displays the glory. And on the other side, you see the effect of the glory. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're being pivoted to walk as the people of Christ in this time.
That is very powerful. Thank you both. I think that's a good place to stop. And we will continue in the Lenten season next time we meet again. And thank you so much for your insights and great contributions, which we hope people will enjoy and be able to share. Thank you. See you next time.
Thank you, Deirdre.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.